Nikhil.
And this is Nick.
And welcome back to Informatonauts.
Hey guys, another week, another show.
So how's it going, Nick? What are you working on these days?
I'm trying to, I'm keeping pretty busy. I'm heavy in classes this quarter, so I haven't been doing a lot of really interesting or exciting things. Got some midterms coming up that I've been preparing for, but still playing around with some different systems. We're going to be doing a lot of JavaScript stuff, and today we may have to do a little bit of shorter show today. I have to go help proctor an exam for a friend.
Oh, nice.
She's in the communications department, and so I'm going to be helping with interpersonal communications, which is funny because that's really not my forte, and I think stereotypically the computer scientist would not be so good at interpersonal communication. But hey, I'm just helping proctor an exam, so nothing too fancy there.
Yeah, ironically, when you're proctor an exam, you do like the opposite of communicating. You have to basically just shut up and stand there and hand out papers and sort of scold people for looking up.
That's true. That's true. It's not exactly what you would anticipate, but. How about yourself? How have things been going with you?
I'm not as heavy on classes as you this quarter, I would imagine, but I am taking a lot of biostats classes, and we just had our first midterm today.
But, how did it go?
It went okay. It was actually, the content was not hard. I think it was pretty cool. The professor I have, his name is Emerson, he's really cool. He basically, he posits that you can do any kind of stats test that we typically do in biostats using regression and only regression. And he's shown us several different ways of performing a chi-square test, a logistic regression, and just whatever question you want to ask, you can answer it through a regression instead of a different stats test. So it's kind of this interesting way of looking at stats where you only need one tool to answer all your questions, as long as you know how to be versatile with that tool.
That is fascinating. Emerson, I'm going to have to look him up. I have to take biostats in the fall. So I'll have to see if he's teaching this one.
Yeah, he's a really cool guy. And besides that, I've been doing a lot of writing and sort of brainstorming paper ideas and just trying new creative ways to come up with new bioinformatics methods. And I have a few that I've kind of been working on. They're not promising yet, but we're getting there. And I guess when I've been writing, and as I've been writing, I found this cool tool called Hemingway. And it's what it does is it basically you type into this online system and it highlights long, complex sentences in yellow. And if it's a sentence that you have highlighted in red, it means that it's just so long that your reader is going to get lost in the middle of it. And it does things like highlight adverbs and it gives you sort of hints and synonyms for better words in different places. It's a pretty cool tool if you are writing a long document and you want to get a different set of eyes on it.
Interesting. Now, does it have any other features? Because I'm thinking, like, just simply the length of a sentence isn't necessarily a good indicator of complexity or wandering. Sometimes some sentences are just thicker than others. So it seems like maybe not as super useful of a tool as it seems on first brush.
Mm-hmm.
So does it have anything else, or is that primarily what it does?
That's primarily what it does. I mean, it does, things like... it highlights things that could be rewritten to be an active voice as opposed to passive voice. But sometimes in science, you write things in mm-hmm. passive voice on purpose. I don't know. I guess, on the surface, I guess it depends on what you're trying to do with it. If you are writing in general and you want to see if you've written something that could be, better, this tool will help identify that and will draw your attention to areas that need it.
Interesting. What does it connect with? Does it run in Word or on an online system, or how does that work?
I think you can download a desktop version of the online application, but as far as I can see, I don't think there's a Word plugin for it. I think you just have to use the online system or download the external app.
Okay, interesting. Now, when you're doing writing, do you still use Scrivener?
I use Scrivener every now and then. Yeah.
What's your writing kind of situation or setup look like? How do you rip through these papers?
I break it down into basically sections and ideas. So I'll have an ideas folder, and then from there I'll turn that in that idea folder I'm going to have different ideas, right? Idea one, idea two, idea three, and I'll take idea one and start to write a paper out of it. Even before I've done the experiment, I'm going to write up the background. I'm going to write up you know, what my theory is, the hypothesis, and then kind of outline the conclusion of what I expect to see, and then I'll run the experiment. And if things pan out and I want to publish that, I'll go ahead and fill out the rest of the form, like, you know, that I've set up for myself, and forward it on to my advisors. If not, I'll just trash it, or I'll, you know, and other times I have to like put stuff in the back burner, and it's an easy way to do that, because you can just sort of take that folder or that idea and drop it back in the back burner folder as opposed to the active projects folder, and juggle things in that way.
Interesting. Very interesting.
But what's the thing is, the Scrivener, I use Mendeley a lot, and
there is
no Mendeley plugin for Scrivener, just for Word. And I've checked the internet, and I've even talked to the Scrivener support about this, and they just don't have enough people who want that plugin. If Scrivener did have that Mendeley plugin, and I think the developers of Scrivener should push for this if they really want to see a boost in their market, like their academic market, they should definitely help push for that plugin. Because I would hands down use Scrivener as my one and only word processor if it had Mendeley.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I write really simple papers and stuff. I use Word as everybody else does. And then for more complex or kind of systematic works, I tend to use LaTeX because I'm firmly rooted in 1987. But it's actually really nice, and it works great with Mendeley because Mendeley does live syncing of the BibTeX entries. So I can just link in a BibTeX file and then cite it. So I like that a lot.
Huh. Well, you're going to have to show me how to do that one day, because I've never tried that. I try and simplify things, and that seems like it might be a bit more complicated than what I wanted to use, but if it's robust, then maybe it's worth it.
It's really robust, and it's really easy to switch. I mean, one of the reasons of using LaTeX is the ability to switch between different formats. So I'm working on a paper right now that is pretty in-depth, and so the first draft will be submitted as a final paper in a class, so that'll have a certain format and uniqueness to it, and then it hopefully will get submitted. I haven't decided if it's going to go to a law review or just go to a journal, but each of those have very distinct formatting and citation requirements. And so with LaTeX, you can either find these templates that people have already built, or you can basically change the formatting, and the content and the formatting are separate from each other. So they're written in all in this kind of all in the same line. So it looks similar to coding a web page, or writing in markup is something that's really similar. As you're changing, you know, global formatting characteristics or whatever, it reformats the citations and the paragraphs and the templates and shrinks the charts down and stuff like that. So it's actually really it's a really easy way to take something and manipulate it into multiple different formats. And of course, because it works with Sweeve, you can actually load R outputs and R files into the paper, and you can rerun them, and they'll live update the results and stuff.
Interesting. Okay, well, that's definitely a bonus. What about CoffeeScript or JavaScript or Python?
I'm sure that I honestly think that you could. I haven't looked into that specifically, but I think I saw something about integrating LaTeX with IPython notebooks, but I don't know that off the top of my head. That's something that'd be interesting to look into, but it's really phenomenal for working with data sets and formatting charts and graphs and images and these kinds of things. So I like LaTeX a lot. I honestly really like it. It's really fast to work with. And since you are splitting the formatting from the actual writing content, it's really easy to just write out your document and then go back and say, okay, I'm going to format this. Whereas Word, I think, it doesn't have to be this way, but it really easily forces you into writing really linear. Whereas you're going through, then you put it in the chart and you format it and reflow the text and do all this. You're really, the formatting and the writing are kind of inherently linked together. Mm-hmm. And LaTeX lets you separate that away.
Okay. But with the markup can get to be kind of tedious, if I remember.
It can get, it's not exactly like markup, but it's a similar mindset. And it can be tedious. So the way that you italicize something is you do / text IT, curly bracket, then this, like, whatever you want to italicize, then close the bracket.
Right.
And that can get a little tedious.
Is there is there a hotkey for it, like in your editor?
I'm sure that there is, and I probably just haven't figured it out.
Maybe if we use Emacs for Vim or something, we could probably set things up to be streamlined.
Probably. I haven't exactly looked into that, but that can be a little bit annoying. But what other things are really nice is being able to, like, citations, it's just / cite and then the key. So you don't have to go through and search for paper titles or authors. You have the citation key, and then throw that in there. And then as you're changing the citation formats, it automatically handles that. So,
well, since you're using such an explicit way of writing papers, you may have to increase your insurance premiums just because you're going to be more likely to get a carpal tunnel and a bunch of other issues.
Maybe. But anyway, so that's the way that I've been working. And so this paper that I'm working on is kind of interesting. It's looking at the concepts of big data and the internet and machine learning and algorithms, things like that, and linking it back to fundamental philosophical ideas, and looking at how it fits in with our current understanding of of justice or political organization, and then taking the approach that the way that we've consistently thought or operated with big data is not sufficient going forward. That is actually taking a backward stance that's going to be quite limiting and potentially harmful in the future. So looking at how do we start to adjust our ethic of data or our ethic of privacy and prevention of harm to fit in with kind of predictive modeling and some of the things that are emerging with data usage.
Cool, really cool.
Yeah, so we'll see what comes out of that, but right now I'm in the middle of kind of the lit review and trying to organize, say, how on earth am I supposed to, like, how on earth do I clean this up and put this into like a 30-page paper or something?
You know, I've been trying to set up my Feedly, and I don't know if you might know a better feed application for this, like RSS application, but I've been trying to get like my subscriptions to academic journals into like an RSS feed, so that way in the morning when I go through my daily list of, you know, websites and comics, I can also get a bunch of updates on what was published that week. And that way I can keep up with the literature without actually having to go to a journal club or any of that.
Now that's interesting. Do the journals have RSS feeds?
No. What I've been doing is I've been kind of using
page scraping
as a proxy, because mm-hmm. the library. So I do a search every morning and I kind of scrape that.
Now that's interesting.
And I organize it by date and relevance, and then that's how I get that information. But it's not very good.
Yeah. Now Google Scholar, because they have my search history, will give me has been starting to give me some really good citation alerts of saying that these new papers that you might be interested have been published, and it's still fairly narrow. It tends to give me more computer science papers, but it's been slowly improving. So that's something that I've been really liking.
Huh. Okay. Well, let's see if I can repurpose that to sort of alert me about a paper that.
Yeah.
That is in the vein of research that I am interested in.
I could imagine that you could. I mean, you can do that with like Google keyword alerts and things like that. So I'm sure there's something like that for Google can do everything.
Well, that would be a good thing to look into. I'm going to write that down as a to-do.
But Feedly is awesome, is it not?
I like it. It's, you know, I have the iPhone version.
Yep.
I have the iPad version, and I have it on my browser somewhere. But it's just kind of out of the way.
I have it. It's always my first tab in my browser.
Really?
And yep. And so I flip again in the morning. I just flip to, you know, I use Chrome, so Apple One,
mm-hmm.
and flip through and read. I don't have it very well. I need to organize it. Right now, it's just kind of all lined up in there. I do a lot of manual curation, but I should probably let it help me do that a little bit better. But it's great. When they shut down Google Reader, I was really disappointed.
Yeah, livid, right?
Yeah. What's interesting was that Google said, I was reading an article about this, and Google said, well, the usage is just down. People aren't using it nearly as much as they used to, so, and we can't open source it because it's so tied in. I guess, and again, I just used it for all the manual type of stuff, which is why Feedly was basically just a drop-in replacement. But apparently they had a bunch of stuff that was tied back into the Google services that they couldn't just detangle and open source it. And they said, you know, people really aren't using it much anymore, so we're going to shut it down. And somebody brought up the idea that while the raw number usage is probably a lot lower, the people who are using it have a disproportionate influence over the internet. that the people who are using it continuously and regularly are the tech writers and the bloggers and the researchers and the aggregators. And so these are the people that are using it.
I was just thinking that. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not just a numbers game. It's really about it. It's really about the concept of influencers. And so that was an interesting thought, but I guess it was not strong enough to sway Google's idea.
Well, I guess Google's business model is based off of advertisements, right?
Yeah.
So I don't remember whether or not they actually would serve ads.
I don't remember either. Maybe just like that little top bar like they've been doing in like Gmail and stuff.
Yeah, so maybe it just wasn't worth like the revenue they were making off of it. And that may be what they meant by not enough folks are using it, not enough folks are using it for us to make money.
Yeah, that's probably actually pretty true.
Like it just may not have been worth it for them. Yeah. So, but yeah, it's a shame. And I think a lot of great applications have, like you said, popped up and are starting to fill that niche. But at the same time, there's just so many of them. I want one to rule them all sometimes just to keep things simple, you know?
It's true. I spent a lot of time looking for a replacement Google Reader and tried a few and wasn't really happy with them. And then Feedly was just simple and easy to use. It was funny, when I switched and then they shut down Google Reader and then I couldn't access the service anymore because everybody was jumping ship and it brought them to their knees. And that was both funny and, you know, humorous and exciting or whatever, but yeah, so that one is simple, easy to use and really high quality, so.
Cool.
Yeah.
So I heard you were presenting in a public health class last week, or at least you helped Anne.
I did.
How'd that go?
That was interesting. So what I did was, and you know, in our public health class, they have to do their winnable battles. So they have to take one of the CDC defines these big public health issues that they think are solvable, but are going to require like big concentrated campaigns. So one is global vaccination or team global vaccination. Another one is like combating obesity in the U.S. And they're not defined goals. Like globally, there are like the Millennium Development Goals the idea is to have childhood poverty extreme poverty by 50% by 2015. And we actually hit that goal. So extreme poverty in the world is now half of what it was.
That's awesome.
It's exciting, yeah. But the CDC just kind of talks about these public health issues that can be solved or can be dealt with but require effort. And so, you know, in our public health class, we have to do an informatics of a solution to something like this. So, well, yeah, so I went in and helped out with their kind of brainstorming time. So they were broken up into groups. And they were working through different stakeholders, and they'd done a basic stakeholder analysis. And so now they were trying to figure out what specifically are we going to tackle? How are we going to do it? Who cares about it? And so I got to go around, spend some time with each of the four or five groups, and kind of help them brainstorm and come up with different ideas. And it was really fun. One of the things that I noticed was people, and we're all guilty of this, they immediately went to a technology solution.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of this was they actually weren't supposed to come up with a solution yet. They were supposed to identify a problem area. So it was small enough that they could scope it. And the informatics solution would come later. But really they just wanted them to get the process of thinking through all of this and dealing with this, really saying, okay, let's identify an area and find a problem. And then let's see how informatics might be able to solve that. As opposed to what I was seeing a lot was that people would take an informatics solution and try to shoehorn that into
a problem,
which right. You can usually get away with because you've got a hammer, right? And there's lots of nails. But this was to identify specifically which nails are sticking out and what kind type of hammer you can apply to it to further convolute the metaphor. And so it was interesting to try and fun to try and say, okay, let's take a step back from this and let's look at this holistically and systematically. And then once we figured out what's kind of our biggest bang from the buck or where does it hurt the most that we can start to deal with and then say, what can we do with informatics?
I think that's been one of the most influential things I've learned here at UW is, especially in this program, is that you don't want to take a solution and go looking for a problem. You want to find the problem first and then identify what solution is going to work best for it. And I didn't think that way before. And I think your example here is just like a testament to that. So
yeah,
I'm glad that the new kids are learning to think about things in this new light.
Yeah, it is exciting. I think this is something. It's again, this is not an informatics issue. It's not even a technology issue. I think people, there's a little bit of a stereotype or a thought that people who are in technology are just always looking for technology solutions, and they're just trying to fit their stuff in wherever they can. And I really think that's most disciplines, most areas of expertise, they are deep into their own set of skills, and everything to them looks, a certain shade of gray, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really difficult to, I mean, there might be, I don't know, there's probably, would you say 50?
50, yeah.
Yeah, probably something like that. So anyway, so it's one of these 50 shades of gray, and part of what the challenge is to try and look at things in a way that says, actually, things might be yellow or things might be pink.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's something that we really have to challenge ourselves with. And I think if you have the ability to do that, it's really, really fun to be able to cross apply solutions from different domains. But I think it really has the potential to deal with some really good issues here.
Right. I think one more thing I learned here is when giving presentations, to not rely on PowerPoints.
Really?
All. Yeah, that was, I think that was Dave's doing. He kind of got me very, very, so we had this teaching class here at UW. We were taught about how to make learning communities and how to teach classes. And what he ended up doing was making us tape ourselves. And I became a lot more aware of my body language and the way I was coming off to people. And it was not the way I expected, not at all. And what I realized then is that I have a lot of dependence on my PowerPoint. That might just be like the nature of my research. I need to show visuals and make things very clear with slides. But I actually like nowadays just to sort of walk into a room and sit down on top of the desk and just have a chat with people. And then, if people ask me a question about a visualization or if I want to talk to them about a concept, I'll go up to a whiteboard or on a piece of paper, just like draw a diagram. And I found this to be a lot more effective in terms of engagement, of audience engagement, and making them feel involved in like a seminar course type of thing, than sort of walking in there with like a PowerPoint and going up to a podium. I don't know if you've tried to do this before, but I definitely have found it to be very, very different.
I've done that kind of off and on. I generally, when I'm giving a presentation, I generally like to use slides, partially because I'm such a visual person. And so to me, it helps to link in what the person is saying to what I'm seeing in the back, on the back PowerPoint. But I've given talks and done stuff where there's nothing like that, and you're just kind of up there talking. And I was actually in a talk 2 weeks ago on ethics and robotics with Ryan Callow, one of the faculty in the law school here. And he did that same, literally, exactly what you described. Sit on the desk and have a conversation. And it was one of the better lectures that I've been in.
Right.
I think that works especially well in a small group where you can sit and engage the people directly. But yeah, I think I see what you're saying, in that it's really easy for PowerPoint to become a crutch, where you spend so much time building in all the slides, or you go in information overload and all this stuff, and you kind of miss the fact that you're giving a talk, right? And that is, it's not just standing up there. If they wanted to, they could just click through your slides on SlideShare, but they actually want to hear you present and see you talk about what you're doing.
Right. Yeah, I think the largest audience I've tried that with is about 50 people, and that was at InfoCamp in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
When I just got, it was, InfoCamp is on conference we have at UW, hosted by the iSchool, and I went down there, and there were folks talking about EMRs and the benefits and the challenges. So I went ahead and made a whole like section for that, like a whole talk. I got a room and I went up there and I facilitated a whole group of 50 people into a really interesting conversation. So I think that is, I think for now at least, until I find a reason to not use this method, it's going to be like my de facto standard.
All right, that's awesome. Are you gonna? So you're gonna do this for our RoboPets seminar?
I don't know. I'm not sure if I'm gonna have time to do a guest lecture in that seminar this quarter. But If I do, I'd love to.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I need to just get a bunch of other stuff done. I've actually been spending way too much time on Flappy Bird.
Wait. You've been playing Flappy Bird.
I've been losing time to Flappy Bird. Like, my sister told me about this game, and I had no idea it existed. And then, like, I started to learn about, you know, the whole controversy behind it and how it ended up being this huge, huge phenomenon over I guess it was December or November, whenever it hit the top 50. About,
yeah, right around then.
And that may have been sort of fraud, or it may not have been. Like, it could have been robots that did that, or may not. Either way, the guy who made the game was making about, I guess they estimated $50,000 a day.
Yeah, that's what he said.
And then he pulled it off the store, the iStore, like the App Store, because it was making too much money, getting too much attention, and it was changing his lifestyle, apparently. And as an indie developer, he couldn't maintain it. So, really interesting story, I would say. But I got the game just to play it, and I have been addicted. My best score so far has been 34.
Wow, I've heard that's quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, I guess
34.
So. I don't know like what the highest score ever has been, but I was obsessed for quite a while.
So now you actually have Flappy Bird on your iPhone.
I do. Yeah.
Are you going to sell it on eBay for $1,000 or whatever? Do you hear about this?
No.
Yeah, there are Flappy Bird iPhones and Android phones with Flappy Bird are up on eBay now for like $1,000 or whatever.
And people are buying them?
That I don't know. I just saw an article saying that they were up. It seems silly because there are already, part of the controversy was that this is like a clone, right? So there's lots of other stuff that exists out there already. And so I can't imagine, oh my gosh, you're playing Flappy Bird right now.
I am.
I don't know how you got 34. You're really not that good at it. anyway, sorry audience. Nikhil's distracting me with colors. But anyways, there's so many of these different kinds of applications already out there that I can't imagine that people would spend any money on something like that. Like, I could imagine if there was one game. Oh, so the other thing this ties into were, like, the original, there were some original, like, Mario Kart Nintendo cartridges that were going for a ton of money. Mm-hmm. And I can, in some sense, imagine somebody buying that as like a collector's item, right? Because it's like, it's a classic piece of gaming, a classic piece of Americana. And there's Mario Kart, and that's it. There's some other, you know, there's like those, like DK Racing or whatever, but really it's Mario Kart. But this is just one of those endless runner type games. And I was reading, I think it was in The Atlantic or something, and there are, you know, listing off all these alternatives that already exist and all this stuff. And so
alternatives to Flappy Bird.
Yeah, oh, because there's just lots of. There's one. It's called like Iron Suit or something like that. And basically, it's the same thing. Only instead of a bird, it's like a little plane, and so you, fly through it. And well, yeah, it's just. Anyways, but yeah, so they had this piece in The Atlantic that I was reading, and it was basically, I think the title was "Video Games as Endless Squalor." Or something like that. I mean, and it was the most pretentious and bitter article that I had read in a long time. And just the squalid grace of Flappy Bird. It says, why playing stupid games staves off existential despair. Games are grotesque. And this is by Ian Bogost, I guess.
Bogost?
And it was Bogost, yes. It was kind of a bogus article. And just like, I think this guy was angry that he'd wasted so much time playing Flappy Bird and decided to justify the fact of why it wasn't just him being dumb and wasting time, that it was actually like a detriment to society and all this stuff. It says he compares it to fixing a broken bathroom door or a bathroom drawer that just won't get, I don't know, it was ridiculous. So there you go, Iron Pants by Edwardus Klonowskis or something like that. Yeah, it's basically a little guy in an iron suit flying around. So,
well,
yeah. So that was interesting. And then Jeff Vogel had a great piece on defending. Was it Doug Nguyen? Is the author kind of defending him and saying that there's a lot of pressure being an indie developer and you get a lot of vitriol. I think he says something like the internet's filled with terrible people, which very well might be. And it's interesting because he talks about the game, and he doesn't defend the game. He's like, obviously, it's just like silly and ridiculous and whatever. But as a developer, as a creator, like, it's entitled to some sort of, you know, some measure, modicum of respect and and all this kind of stuff. So it's actually a really good article. And he mentioned the Atlantic one. And he said, in the most pretentious, awful grad school style, is what he refers to.
You know, sometimes, I don't know if this was the case with Don Nguyen, or I forget what his name was. You just mentioned it, but it slipped my mind. But sometimes you just make things for fun, like just to try things out and just to see what happens. Like you may not have expected it to take off the way it did. It's a free app, by the way. Like when I downloaded it was completely, I didn't have to pay for it.
People are complaining about free, right? And there's in some sense there's a right justification of that. The app world is filled with a lot of garbage and a lot of crap, and sometimes it can be very difficult to filter through that, and people are tired of downloading these crappy applications and getting them on their phone, and they feel
that's like saying I'm obese because I can't get this bag of Doritos off my body, and it's Doritos' fault for making it taste so good that I can't get rid of it. Like, it's just so...
I don't know if I could quite go there. I do agree that it's ridiculous to complain about free stuff, but it's also... I think that there's also some justification in saying this is like... I'm just being like turned off by the fact that people are just pumping out this crap for no good reason, and that there are people that are getting sucked into it, right? I mean, I get frustrated at a lot of this stuff. You know, being around public health, right? It's very easy to vilify and be angry at places like McDonald's and Coca-Cola because they are selling something that, I don't like McDonald's, but I love Coca-Cola, right? It's I love Coke. And yes, I just said I love Coke. Anyways,
you gotta cut your pinky finger there. Your pinky nail's getting a bit long.
Yeah, you know, it's a little bit longer than it needs to be, so I'll trim that down. But you know, I love these things. I like these things, and I get frustrated that people take it to an extreme, but that it's easy to do because of all the stuff that goes into it. So I understand people like being frustrated by a lot of this stuff, but again, it's free, people. It's different if you're charging them $3 and it's a crappy, awful application and you're not being responsive to customer needs or giving refunds and things. Like, that's totally different. This is just ridiculous, though.
Yeah, I agree. It's definitely something that needs to change in a certain way. Like, you know, on one hand, I think whenever an app is free, I have no value for it because, you know, easy come, easy go. I download it, I use it, I don't like it, I delete it, you know?
Yeah.
But whenever I pay for an app, I want to keep it. And in this case, because I guess the app has been pulled off the app store, I don't want to delete it.
Right.
Just because it's like this kind of
It's valuable
novelty.
Now.
It's a novelty item.
You're one of the few people, well, I guess not the few, you and like 45 million of your friends are now carrying Flappy Bird. But,
yeah,
you know, but it's a scarce resource now. So I totally get that. You know, I've been toying with the idea of releasing, of, you know, whipping up a couple apps or something. One, to kind of play around and test it out. But I've got a few things that I think might be useful to some people. And I've been in my mind wrestling back and forth with this idea of, do I do it for free and maybe have either just do it for free and just, you know, eat the cost and just say, here you go, world. Maybe throwing in a little bit of advertising, even though it's not, I don't like that method. Maybe to cover like systems costs or something, or do I charge, you know, a buck or two for it and make it? And it wouldn't really change. It might change a little bit. I mean, every time you have skin in the game, it changes the way that you work and the way that you interact. That's just human nature. So it might incentivize me to write a little bit of a better app than I might otherwise. But the question is, you're creating, in a sense, you're creating a social. You are creating a contract with the people that purchase your app. You're guaranteed something. And people have expectations.
You want to hear a funny story?
Yes.
So in I think 2010 or 2011, I think probably 2010, I started to get into Android development. And that's just because I wanted to learn Java. I had no idea how to use Java. I used C and C++. And I wanted to get into iPhone development, but, you know, I guess I didn't want to pay up $100 for a license. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to commit to it, you know?
Yep.
So I went ahead and just started to play with Android. And I ended up going to the internet and finding a bunch of stub code and going to Stack Overflow and just sort of piecing together a bunch of libraries and code snippets. And I understood what they did, but I didn't quite, you know have a good handle on the actual libraries I was using.
Yep.
And either way, I designed the application. I spent a lot of time like figuring out what app I want to have, what apps I want to make. So I made two apps. One was one called Pickup Lines, which is just a list, literally a list of pickup lines that I scraped off the internet from a bunch of websites. And just to see how it, you know, what happens to it. And this one was free. This was a free app. And then the second one I made was a application called Sunrise Alarm, which basically is an alarm clock which will wake you up at sunrise based on your GPS location. So if the sun comes up at 4 a.m., it's going to wake you up at 4 a.m. and say, get up, buddy, the sun's coming out. Or if you're going to be waking up at 6, you know, in the winter, that's the same thing. In general, in Seattle, the sun comes up really late in the winter and really early in the summer.
So it's huge. It's very big difference.
Right. And if you want sunlight, you better get up as soon as possible. So the first app, the Pickup Lines app, was the free app, was ended up being at one point like in Google's or in Android's top 20 apps.
Again,
I had thousands and thousands of downloads and people, a lot of installs. And because of that, A-Press Publishing actually approached me and they were like, hey, you're a top Android developer. Do you want to be a technical reviewer on our Android book? And I was like, yeah, sure, because it's going to help me really understand more of Java and how to use it. And I did that book and I spent a lot of time going through the code and validating it. And I swear to God, that's one language I'm not going back to,
because
I just can't take Java. I mean, if I have to do it, I will, but I'm going to be biting a bullet and gritting my teeth. The other one, the Sunrise Alarm, and this is Android, an app, you know, a platform where people don't like to pay for applications predominantly. And I was still making sales. I made over 100 sales.
What was the price that you sold that for?
$5.
$5?
Yeah.
That's really high in Appland.
Yeah. But it's, you know, and for over 100 sales, that's pretty good. I think that's not bad at all.
No.
And this is over the course of 2 or 3 years now with no marketing at all. Like, that's all just organic traffic. And I would imagine that had I made the same application on an iPhone, on a platform where people expect to pay a buck or two for an app, I would have made a lot more. And I do have an Apple like developer license now, and I do have, you know, an iPhone developer license now. So it may be, you know, it's something to explore if I get the time to do it. But
yeah,
that's absolutely the problem, to get time to do it.
I think that, you know, the problem now is that there's so much, the market is so heavy and occluded that it's really difficult, I think, to find innovative and interesting things to do, especially for something that's going to exist just solely on a phone. It's different tying it into a back-end, you know, web service or something that you're giving somebody a more native interface to work with your service. But even then, it doesn't get a whole lot easier, I don't think.
But the point is that you should build it not because you can build it, but you should build it because it needs to exist.
Yeah.
You think it needs to exist.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And the, you know, the barriers to entry are so low now. A developer license is, what, $100 for iOS?
Yeah, it's low for us, but I'm sure for somebody with no experience in coding, it's like a big barrier to entry, because they have to learn how to code first before they...
Oh, absolutely. And it's not that it's no entry, but Apple has done such a good job with their developer tools that Objective-C, in as much as it's like... I mean, it's basically, you read the code, it's like reading a book, right? It's like verbose and like all this stuff that... That's really amazing. I mean, I remember I was writing, you know, I took a class in college on microprocessors and ended up writing a lot of like of assembly code, and that, like, that's what people used to write in. That is impossible to learn. I spent a week working on a multiplier. I mean, it's just, it's intense at times. And now what we're able to do, and now even with iOS 7, you have, what is it, like auto layout or interface builder or something. And well, you have interface builder, but you have like auto layout and stuff. They just keep removing these barriers. And now anybody can say, I'm interested. I think that this should exist. I think there's a market for it. And I can, even if I have to learn to code, write it, pay $100 for the developer license, and publish it. Maybe it doesn't take up. Maybe it's not going to hit the top 20 or whatever. But maybe I get a couple hundred sales. I'm going to recoup my costs, mm-hmm. and I built something and contributed something to the world. I think that's really cool.
It is, yeah. But the hard part, like, you'd be surprised. You know, I thought maybe an app would take, even a simple like Pickup Lines app. That app, I expected it to take maybe an afternoon, on a Saturday to build. It took 3 weeks.
You were also working in Java.
Yeah, but you know, garbage. I think that just has to go. I think any app you build is going to take a much longer time to actually build it than you think, because you're going to hit some snags here and there. You're going to get feedback from people who are going to be like, I don't like this thing that you did, but you might like it, but you have to just kind of, you know, eat your pride and sort of make the changes, because they're like, they're users, and users are probably more right than you are as an egotistical developer. So you have to just, you know, there's things like that that kind of slow you up. But at the end of the day, I think, I mean, my estimate now, like, I know whenever I code something for, like an application or a script for somebody, I think about how long my gut says it's going to take. If it's going to take an afternoon, I'll just tell them it'll take 2 afternoons to do, because I know that, like, as a rule of thumb for me personally. But for iPhone apps and for Android apps, I actually multiply it by 4.
By 4. So I know the rule of thumb I've heard is the 3, right? You multiply by 3, and that's just kind of the general rule of thumb. But 4, that's a good chunk. Now, that was back in 2010, right? So what was that? Was that Android, like, was that Froyo or something like that?
It was Android, it wasn't quite 4 yet. It was 3 point something.
Okay.
Going into 4.
It'd be interesting to go back now and rewrite that, or to try to jump in now and see what Google, I know Google's been putting a lot of money, one, into all their APIs and cleaning a lot of that stuff up, so it'd be interesting to go and to see what you'd be able to do.
I thought Google was going to dump Android at a certain point. Like, I just thought that, okay, like, there's the Windows Phone exists, it's beautiful, and the iPhone is awesome. Android is just, like, it's just so open. It's just, there's no unity or solidarity. And, like, you know, there's certain companies, like, I guess Samsung or Nokia, I forget. I think Samsung. They just don't push changes, like OS changes, if you do it yourself. And all sorts of things like that. I thought it was just too hard to maintain, that they're gonna scrap it. But it looks like they didn't scrap it at all. They've actually been maintaining Android for quite a while now.
Now, that's interesting. So there was an article on Ars Technica, actually recently, and they were linking to one back in October, where looking at, Google's been largely abandoning the AOSP, the open source project. And they've been doing a lot of updating, but they're moving a lot of those APIs up into the Google Play services, which are not open source, and those are in Google land.
Yeah.
And it's really fascinating. It's interesting the way that they structure all of that. So I think Google is really doubling down on, if not Android as an open source system, the whole Android as Google's OS. When you look at it, they have a lot of vested interest in that. It continues to place their product in front of the eyeballs of millions and millions of people.
Yep.
Now, one thing that's interesting that was brought up was the idea of what should Microsoft do going forward? Should they fork Android, the open source project, and basically build their own services on top of it?
I don't know. Off the bat, I would say no, but I don't think they quite understand where their motivation is or where their vision is. Because if Google maintains Android primarily, and if Microsoft is gonna, that's not what's happening though, right? Like, it's not like Microsoft is going to give up to Google. They're going to.
Well, they wouldn't really be giving up to Google, because part of it would be. Abandoning Windows Mobile, which really hasn't been able to attract the developers and the user base that they would like it to, and so if you build off of Android, there's less code that you need to migrate. So you don't connect to all the applications, because a lot of applications are tied in with Google, but you would basically just need to replicate. You'd have a base OS, which one would get you on a lot more devices, because the places like Broadcom and Qualcomm and Marvel are already writing to work with the base OS. So then what you would have to do then is just write kind of your user land, which, one, Microsoft has a great, I like the interface a lot. I think it's really, really awesome. Obviously, a lot of that would probably get jettisoned, but the Bing services are quite good. I've worked with them with a couple projects, and I like them. I think Google's are better, but Bing's are solid, and I wouldn't be afraid to use them, especially on a .net package. And so if they kind of wrote all of their services in to replace what Google has, which is kind of like what Amazon's been doing, then that gives them a much larger base to then leverage their muscle.
I so agree. Yeah, I think a lot of the strength for the iPhone and for Android sometimes comes from this vertical supply chain.
Yeah.
Like, because they control all the components that go into that phone, they can control how they all interact together. And there's a lot of power in that. It's very, very underrated.
There is.
And, yeah, I think Microsoft so far has kind of been looking for love in the wrong places. So that's just why they haven't been able to capitalize. But they have a good product. I just don't see... I think maybe if they did something drastic, like give Windows phones away to students for free or something like that, where you had a bunch of early adopters. I think there was a guy... a marketing guy. It wasn't, God, I forget his name, but he talked about these 1,000 true fans. Have you heard of this?
It sounds familiar.
If you have a product and you can get 1,000 true fans to work, to use it and to be just crazy about it and to be evangelists, then your thing's going to take off. Basically, like, that's all the momentum it needs to get going. So,
well, the Windows Phone fans tend to be pretty adamant. They'd be very evangelistic.
Yeah, but there's also like this kind of like, oh, well, it's a Windows phone. You know, it's going to be, it's mm-hmm. cheap and it's, you like it because you're a Windows user kind of a thing, as opposed to, and when you use it, it's not very intuitive. Like, so it might be beautiful. A Windows phone might be beautiful, but like, I can't just pick it up and know how to use it. Like, it's not designed in that way. It's designed to be pretty, but it's not designed to be intuitive, I would say. Whereas the iPhone is kind of just like, it's not as pretty, I would say, but it just tends to, we just all know how to use it.
That may be true, but the question is that true because iOS is more intuitive, or true because it's so ubiquitous and we see it on commercials and we see it on television shows that people just have an idea? You always see people using iPhones.
I don't know. Whatever it is, at the end of the day, people just gravitate toward more towards iPhones than they do to mobile, to Windows phones. So
now here's an interesting thought. Somebody also, I think this is also in the Ars article, or somebody else. And what they brought up was, what if Microsoft partnered with Apple to basically, because Apple and Google are not getting along,
mm-hmm.
and Apple's trying to replace all of their stuff, and it's really not working. Their backend services are really messy. People really don't like iCloud. Developers don't like it. It's really frustrating. So what if Microsoft came to Google came to Apple and said, "Well, we'll write all of that stuff for you. We'll leverage the Azure Cloud, Bing Maps, Bing Search."
We're going back to the 1970s when Bill Gates went to Steve Jobs and he was like, "Hey, why didn't I work on this GUI for you?" And it's like, have you heard that?
Yeah. Well, or the Microsoft Office is the one that they were able to negotiate that they would continue to support. Microsoft Office is beyond the Mac for... So it's basically going back to the 90s. But think about what that would... Think about the market that you would get if all of a sudden everybody by default was just using Bing.
Yeah. Yeah, it would definitely be a monster move. And I think it would benefit Apple and Microsoft. But at the same time, as Apple, would you want to trust Microsoft? Because they've already screwed you once.
Except that I think the tables are really reversed here. Microsoft needs to make a move in this space. It's really reversed. They're kind of, the phrase I heard was crawling hat in hand. I think that's a little bit extreme. But I think that there's a lot of saying, look, there's a lot of mutual benefit here. Microsoft is not a serious player in this space.
Well, sure, but like, I mean, back in the day when Apple first had, I think it was Lisa, they were, you know, they basically had a GUI, mm-hmm. and Microsoft went to go work with them to build applications, and they basically just ripped off the entire operating system and made their own, you know, calculator that looked identical, made their own everything.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, that was a big, big thing, because they were betrayed in that way.
Yeah.
And that's why I think that was sort of the start of the whole animosity between Apple and Microsoft users. And Microsoft, they also went to market like before anybody else did,
yeah.
which is why they quote unquote won.
Yeah,
but
that's interesting. That's a good thought. I think things are different today. Different leadership. Tim is not going to get suckered. Nobody's going to pull contract silliness with Tim Cook. That's his wheelhouse right there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that Microsoft has little incentive to do this, because there's a little incentive to try and beat Apple, because there's just different markets there. Microsoft's proved that they really just can't build an OS, a phone OS, and a phone platform to compete with the iPhone. But Apple has I think, pretty staunchly proved that they really just can't do web services.
Well, why does Microsoft have to be in the realm of phones anyway? Like, it's not like they cared, you know,
they don't
10,
have
20
to,
years ago.
They don't have to be in the realm of phones, but I think they have to be in the realm of mobile. That is, that market is so much bigger than anything else that exists in the PC space, that if they're not a player, they're going to get relegated in a large sense to irrelevance.
But that was a long time coming. Like, you know, even Larry Ellison saw that coming. As a database guy,
yeah.
You know? So I don't know. I think if I was at Microsoft, I'd want to capitalize on different things. Mobile is a big deal, but there's probably other emerging markets that are worth putting time and effort into.
Probably. But a lot of those involve around information retrieval, aggregation, like all that kind of stuff.
Which is a strength for Microsoft.
It is a strength. And that's why, for them, I think it'd be a huge benefit to leverage doing the services for Apple. Because that's where it's moving, to this idea of web service. There's a huge momentum in web services and in search and information retrieval that Apple does not have a strength in, but Microsoft does. And Apple has a strength in mobile and the market,
and
Microsoft does not, and design.
Right.
So one of my favorite things on – there are two things I love about Windows Phone. One is that my wallpaper changes every day to the Bing image of the day, and it's beautiful. And the second is when you search for a person or like movie times or something, they have a really good contextual awareness when they search. And so I'll get a card back. They call them info cards or smart cards. And it'll have – if I search for like Barack Obama – it'll pop up. It'll have this picture, a little short blurb, usually age, birthday, like name, role. If you tap on it, they aggregate a bunch of information, kind of like what Google does with their smart cards.
Mm-hmm.
They do that as well, and it's actually really good. Or when you search for a restaurant, it'll pop up with a little location card, and when you tap on it, it will give you the option to send that address to the map application or transit or look them up in Yelp or something like that. So this ability to link information across domains, which is something that Apple does not have. iOS does not do that for a large sense. And Android does it somewhat, but usually more of whenever it's a Google service talking to other Google services. And Microsoft does that really well. And so being able to leverage those things together could really give Apple a huge boost in playing with and going against Google.
Possibly, but what you just said, you just mentioned that there are not that many Microsoft apps out there,
right?
In their app store. And I would imagine that at this point, a lot of Microsoft developers are the ones who, like, you know, in-house, the ones who make the applications.
Yeah, it's
and
very true.
And I think that's why they can integrate them so well, because otherwise, if I make an app on the iPhone, I'm not going to know how to integrate that with the Yelp app. Like, I'm going to have to get some kind of an API key and a bunch of permissions from the user. It's going to be complicated. But if I was in-house and like the guy who made the Yelp app was right next to me, it would be very different.
Yeah.
So I think that's actually a strength for Microsoft and their phone if they know how to leverage that.
That could very well be.
Microsoft maybe shouldn't even open their development program to anybody else, and they should just maybe curate their own applications and do a completely different approach than anybody else.
Well, I think that's actually kind of similar to Palm had to do that with WebOS.
Mm-hmm.
They had to write a lot of the apps themselves, as did BlackBerry.
Right.
And where are those companies today?
Yeah, they're gone.
So I think that's one of the appeals of going to, I would love to stay in the Windows Phone platform. And I'm seriously considering switching either back to iPhone, back to iOS, or to Android, partially because Microsoft just can't keep pace with all the things that I can do. All the like random utility applications that I can live without, banking apps or different, like Pocket. They can't get Pocket on the Windows Phone. Like all this type of stuff. It's not that I need that or that I desperately have to have it, but the question is, why do I need to go without it? Why do I need to forfeit it?
Right.
And so many of these applications are written by Microsoft because they can't get the big players to come and write to that. And if they can't get the big players to come, how on earth are they going to get the little guys? And the problem is that right now there's not a parity, but Microsoft's not too far behind. But I really don't see them being able to keep pace for much longer.
In the big picture, I think Microsoft should focus on what it's good at doing and sort of let everything else it's mediocre at go.
So
just focus on the good.
So if you were to tell, so what would you tell Microsoft, what would you tell Satya to jettison, and what would you tell him to really double down on?
Well, you know, I don't know too much about their entire product line mm-hmm. at the moment.
Well, right, but
mobile phones would not be something that I would focus on. I'd focus on something different. Maybe the tablet, their Surface tablet, because that seems like it's a pretty cool thing to do. Maybe even a different type of application. I know that when Steve Jobs went back to Apple, like in 97 or 2000 or whenever it was, he cut down the product line from like 100 different products down to like 20 because he didn't want to focus on wasting energy on a bunch of stuff that didn't make much of a difference. And I think there's a lot of, you know, there's power in focus. So I don't know. I think that would be my approach. But then again, I'm not a CEO, so I have no idea what those guys are thinking.
Yeah. I think those are good suggestions. I mean, that's part of what having our own podcast. We just get to pontificate and talk about things that we don't really know anything about. Right. And people sit and listen, at least some people.
Speaking of which, though, I actually had a cool thing I worked on yesterday, which okay. almost panned out, but not quite.
Okay.
So I went to go see the optometrist.
Yes.
And I got a new prescription for my like lenses, for my glasses. And it hasn't changed that much. It's basically the same. So I wanted to get a new pair of frames, but then I realized, you know, once I figured out, you know, that this optometrist I saw had a certain selection, I wanted to make my own glasses. I was like, can I even do that? Can I make my own frames? I went to the internet, checked it out. After some research, I figured out that you can actually design your own glasses through like Rhino or CAD, yeah. AutoCAD. And people have done that. And then you can get them 3D printed.
Wow.
Yeah, so I actually I checked out some books from like the library in the health sciences department about optometry, and I was looking to see how like they actually make the glasses and like how you measure them and like where the focal mm-hmm. thing should be, and basically you can make the frames for cheap, for about $30.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's not going to fold up. It's not going to be like a nice pair of glasses. It's going to be something that's going to be stationary and
yeah.
static. But it's doable. And then you take that 3D printed frame, bring it to your optometrist, and they send it to their lens people, and then they put the lens into it, and then...
Interesting.
That's a cheap pair of glasses that you made yourself.
But how much do the lenses cost?
The lenses are pretty expensive. I think it's like $200 for lenses.
Wow.
But your insurance covers most of that if you
have... That's true. Or you could just go to Warby Parker and pay $150 for...
Everything?
But basically, I think I paid $200 for a pair of sunglasses or something, but... But you know, but then you could say, I mean, oh, I love your glasses. What are they? Oh, they're an NG original creation.
Yeah, I made them myself.
That's kind of
put your little insignia in it. It's really cool.
You know, only you would look at that and say, oh, I wonder if I can make my own. But you know, Rhino. I think Rhino is $100 for a lifetime student license.
Really?
Or something like that. Yeah, and it's like full version and no like weird like AutoCAD. You can get it for free as a student, but everything says academic version. You can't use it for commercial. I think mm-hmm. Rhino is just like yeah.
Well, down here in Seattle, they actually have several different places where you can 3D print stuff, like as a service, even if you're not like a member of the place that does it. So it's like a $100 minimum order. So I think with like this template that they give you, you can print maybe 3, 4, 5 different types of frames and then kind of play with them and see if you can. If I could find a way to pop lenses in and out of these frames, that would be wonderful. But yeah. I think because the frames are all different like shapes and sizes, they are going to need their own custom frame. So that's still like a glitch in the system. But yeah. Looking pretty good so far.
Awesome. You'll have to keep us posted on that.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're out of time for today. I know I need to get going and go proctor this exam. But thank you for joining us again for this week. Again, check us out. Follow us on Twitter at Informatonauts. And Nick Robison, Nikhil Gopal on the internets, and check us out, leave us some feedback on the website, let us know what you like, what you dislike, and what things that we can do better.
All right, thanks guys.